So, welcome to this new course, new series. I think something to do with protection. Protection from, I don't actually remember what the title. So it's to seek protection through, understanding refuge and karma. So these are two very, Buddhist topics. So, as usual, over the next 5 weeks, 5 sessions, we're going to look at how to meditate on this topic. And since this is part of a bigger series, which I call Experiencing the Buddhist Teaching, so my aim is that is to look at how can we reflect. Think and meditate on this topic in order for us to have some direct experience of the Buddha's teaching, especially Buddha's teaching related to this topic of refuge and karma. So, in general, when we study anything, like any information, what happens is we receive that information from outside of us. So in a sense, it's other people's knowledge, right? And so we learn about it. And these days, we have many options, many ways of learning. Whereas in the old days, especially in India, during the Buddha's time, learning is primarily through oral, through a teacher talking or reciting and the student listening. And a lot of the knowledge are actually passed on orally, so it requires memorization. Yeah. So these days we are kind of, in a way, lucky, maybe not. So most of the time we never memorize anything, right? So we just kept everything on the phone. Then, you know, hopefully you back up the phone, because otherwise if you lost the phone, you practically lost everything, including all your passwords and everything. But those information, those knowledge that we acquire through listening, to reading, to watching videos and so on, nonetheless, still, although we kind of receive it, but they are in a way still not our knowledge. Even though we may be able to repeat them, we may be able to pass examination by repeating those information. We have not achieved a very important step, which is, we can call it integration. We have not integrated the knowledge. We have not assimilated the knowledge. We have not made that information, that knowledge, a part of who we are, you know, a part of ourselves. So so sometimes I call it indigestion. You know, you're taking the food. The food is sitting inside somewhere, you know, in your guts, you know, in your stomach or your intestine. But you have not digested it. No. So in a way, it's still foreign to you. You have not extracted out the nutrients. Right? And so have not actually fully benefited from that food that you have taken in. And likewise, quite often we might acquire knowledge, let's say knowledge related to Buddhism. So in fact, I can, you know, that knowledge may enable me to just sit here and talk for 1.5 hours, you know, but that does not necessarily mean I have assimilated it, I have integrated it into my way of life, my behavior, my way of thinking, my view of the world, and therefore I have not, in a deep sense, not benefited from that knowledge, that information. It remains somehow still alien, you know, still outside of me, even though, you know, of course I can recollect it, I can use the words and so on, but I have not made it a part of myself, and in so doing, I have not actually fully benefited from that knowledge. Right? So that is missing the step of integration and assimilation. And this is, in a way, is a great pity, because having made the effort, you know, the time to learn about this, learn and acquire this information and knowledge. Why not take that next step and try to integrate it and try to extract out the nutrients, the essence from that knowledge. Extract out in such a way that you yourself can make use of it, you yourself can fully benefit from it. So that's what I mean by experiencing the Buddhist teaching. Not just knowing about the Buddhist teaching, but actually be able to experience it, be able to see how it has affected you in a positive way, to receive the positive impacts of the Buddhist teaching in your own life, in your own experience. And I think that is actually a very important thing. Otherwise, you will suffer from spiritual indigestion. And somewhere along the way, who knows, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years down the road, you suddenly find that you need to regurgitate it out. You need to get rid of it. And the pity is, you have not fully benefited from it in that way. Right? So, there are certain things we can do to facilitate this process of integration or assimilation. One of the most important things is to try to bring the information and knowledge that you acquire and your own life experiences, bring them closer together. You know? Try to integrate them, try to bind them together in one way or another. And a simple way is to like you have all these different life experiences, which we kind of, we tend to organize it in a way according to our current beliefs, our current habits, not just in terms of behavior, but also habits in terms of the way we see things, we think about them, the way we react to them. So we have all this, we organize our life experiences in a certain way, right? And to make sense of them, to give meaning to them. And one way to integrate new knowledge on them, for example, the Buddhist teaching, into yourself, is to take these life experiences, you know, extract them out, and rearrange them in a way according to the Buddhist teaching, and see whether it makes better sense, if it's more meaningful, or more helpful, more beneficial, you know. And if you find that, hey, you know, how true it is, then that might become a new way for you to organize your life experiences, a new way for you to respond to future situations. So it's a psychological way of talking about this is you reframe your life experiences. You take your experiences, past experiences, out of the old frame, take them out like a photo frame like that, you know, you dismantle it, take out all your photos, album or whatever, and then you rearrange it and give it a new frame, and then you look at it and say, this looks so much better. Yeah. I'm so much happier with this. You know? So then that contributes to your greater happiness. So it's not so much that you need to relive your life again, but it's almost like you relook at your life again. You look at your life, your past, and your present with new eyes, with different eyes. Right? So, and that's one way we can integrate our own experiences with the information, the knowledge you gain from studying the Buddhist teachings. So that's how you put them together. Okay. So let's try to do some of that in this course as well, related to this topic of going for refuge and taking refuge and the teaching of karma in the light of what we consider protection. And what is protection? Protection means protecting ourselves from danger, from things that are unwanted, keeping us safe, feeling secure, safe, and hopefully also happy. Right? So, traditionally, in Tibetan Buddhist tradition, when we present the topic of refuge, I don't know whether, you know, in Buddhism we talk about, we go for refuge to the three jewels or the triple gems, the three things, the Buddha, the Dharma, the teaching, and the Sangha, which is the community of practitioners. So Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the trinity of Buddhism, you know, the three things, yeah. And so part of the topic, presenting this topic is, first of all, we need to ask ourselves, why go for, what does it mean to say, to go for refuge? And why do we want to do that? So that's the first aspect, like why go for refuge? What does it mean? And the second aspect is who or what are the worthy objects of refuge? Which is, and why these three? You know, why not four and five and six? Why these three objects? Actually, I don't know why three. When I study Buddhist philosophy in Italy, under this master program of this FPMT, this Foundation for Preservation of Mahayana Tradition. So I studied for 7 years, and quite often it's a very kind of logical kind of study model on the Tibetan monastic university. Always logic, you know, why this, why that. So one of the questions often asked is why this number, why four of these, why two of that, why three of this, right? And different commentators sometimes give different explanations. One of the most, I have to say, I don't know whether one of the most bizarre explanation I will get is, let's say, three jewels. And one explanation a commentator ever gave is because two is too, would be too little, and four would be too much. That's a wonderful explanation. What can you say, right? So three jewels. So another part of this course we'll look at why these three different objects and what are their qualities, what are their characteristics, and why are they worthy or reliable objects for us to rely on to take refuge in. And then the second half of this course we will touch on the topic of karma. So let's start by taking a look at why go for refuge. What does it mean to go for refuge? Why you go for refuge is you're looking for somewhere that is safe, that is you feel protected, that you will feel secure. Right? So that's the underlying idea of refuge. Right? And on top of the sense of having found refuge is of course this greater idea of that enable you to find happiness, isn't it? No. Of course, if you don't have refuge, you don't feel safe, your life is endangered, then you almost never even have a chance to think about happiness. Because all you're trying to do is to run away from danger, to escape from suffering, to basically to survive, right? It's only when we feel that our survival isn't threatened, we are fundamentally safe, secure, then we can think, how can we make our life better, or the lives of our loved one better, how can we find greater happiness. So that's the underlying idea around refuge. Refuge has very much to do with the idea of finding happiness and being free from suffering, free from the things that you are afraid of, free from the unwanted, and to be able to enjoy whatever it is that brings you happiness. So it's very much tied up with this idea of finding happiness and avoiding suffering, which His Holiness the Dalai Lama often explained in his public teachings that each one of us, as human beings, deep within us, we have this very natural, instinctive desire or wish that we all want to be happy. What we want is to be happy, and what we don't want is to suffer. And in fact, this is one of the things that we can think about, that join all of us together, all human beings share in this common wish, that human beings instinctively, in fact, actually, in Buddhism we say all sentient beings instinctively, maybe not necessarily in words, especially if certain sentient beings don't have language, but nonetheless, what drives us is this instinctive, innate desire to be happy and to not suffer. Of course, a snail and an amoeba and you would define happiness a bit differently, and suffering also a bit differently. But so we're not talking about what is the happiness and what is the suffering, but we're talking about nonetheless there is this underlying wish and desire to be happy and to not suffer. And it's something that is, on the basis of that, we can see how we and other sentiments are in a way equal, the same. We are the same in all wishing and really wanting to be happy and to not suffer. Right? So given that we all have this desire, how can we achieve it? And refuge is usually presented from the point of view of how can we, that there are actually two things, right? What is it that we afraid of? What is it that is unwanted, that we want to avoid? And what is it that is able to protect us from them and to give us refuge? So these are the so-called two causes of refuge. Right? One is, what is the things that we don't want, the things that we fear, the things we seek protection from, away from. And then the other one is the object that can actually give us the protection, the object that can give us the refuge. Right? So the object that can give us refuge, we'll look at a bit later, is the three jewels, according to Buddhism. I'm going to look at this first cause of refuge, is the instinctive wish to, you know, to be free from danger, free from what we find fearful or unwanted or painful. Yeah. So, depending on, of course, then we need to take a look at, well, what is it that we don't want? What is it that we are afraid of? And what, who or what can protect us from that? So from, on the basis of this, you can understand this whole idea of refuge. Refuge is what we find within ourselves that bring us a sense of safety in the face of danger, a sense of relief, you know, in the sense, in the face of stress, a kind of peace and calmness and stability when you encounter maybe life situation that is full of uncertainty, full of whatever it is that you're afraid of or unwanted. So that's the underlying idea of refuge. In fact, the word that normally comes to mind, and normally associated with refuge, is the word faith. But I don't actually like this translation of the word faith. Strada in Pali or Sanskrit. I actually prefer the word trust. Faith is a very loaded word in the modern world, especially, you know, it has a lot to do with very important word in theistic religion like Christianity. Yeah. So instead of using the word faith, let's say I use the word trust. What do you entrust yourself to that can support you and protect you? In fact, the Sanskrit word for faith or trust, some people actually, so its underlying idea is something that you can trust, you can rely on, you can place your heart upon something. You entrust your heart to this object, this person, this idea, whatever it is. Yeah. So that's the whole idea of underlying refuge, this sense of trust. You are able to entrust yourself, your life, or whatever it is to. And in return, it gives you a kind of peacefulness, kind of serenity, right? Because you feel that you are in a way protected and supported. So that's what we are looking at. And I thought, instead of thinking about, you know, oh, what is it that I don't want? What is it that I'm afraid of? What is the unwanted that I want to be free from? Which is quite negative. Yeah. So sometimes it's helpful to look at the opposite of it. What is it that you want? What is it that you wish for? What is it you feel is really necessary in order for you to feel safe and happy, right? So, and also, I actually have a meditation whereby we explore this question, what is it that I really want in order for me to be happy? What is it that I really want in order for me to be really happy, right? So, we're going to do this meditation. Let me explain how to do this. So, we can explore this topic based on this guiding question. And this is one way you can use meditation to integrate your life experiences with the teaching, the Dharma. Right? You can put them together. So the first part of the meditation is to just ask yourself this question. What do I really want or need in order for me to be happy? And it's important to be honest with yourself. And I always tell people, don't worry, man. It's all in the privacy of your meditation. I will never ask you, what is it? What are your answers to this question? And what I recommend people to do is, you just make up a grocery list of, you know, the things that you want or need to be happy. You can have only one item. Just one. Sometimes I only have one answer. I really want this. If I have this, I will be happy. I will be satisfied. It can be one. Or it can be like one big long, like 1,000 items, you know, starting from the right shoe, the right house, the right furniture, the right car, whatever it is. Don't be shy. Okay? Just put down everything that you think you is necessary in order for you to be happy. So you can have a very long list, or it can be a very short list. But the important thing is you must be sincere. What is it that you look into your own heart and mind and ask yourself, what do I really want or what do I really need in order for me to be happy? And then you try to compile this list in your own mind. Yeah. And this becomes a meditation because you are exploring your own feelings, your own thoughts, your own beliefs, what is within yourself. And this is an opportunity also for you to become more aware of your own desires, your own needs, your own wants, and allow them to come to mind, to come into awareness. Yeah. And don't be too shy and don't try to look good to yourself. Anyway, no, nobody will know what is your wish list, so you can just be honest about it. And the second part I will ask you to do is, now imagine by the power of magic, you actually miraculously have every single item on that list. It just all come true. You know, house, partner, children, the right type of children you want, you know, the one you can send back and then get a new one. And then, all, whatever material, spiritual, whatever it is that you need, you arrange it. Ta-da! Then you ask yourself this question. Am I happy? Right? And if you say yes, then you ask yourself, how long will I be happy? Like, for example, you live in your dream house. Right? First hour may be very nice. Second hour, okay. First day, second day, 1 week, 1 month, 1 year. Will you be happy? Will you live there happily ever after? So it's a question for you to ask yourself. So the first one is to compile a list. What do I want or need in order for me to be really happy? And the second one is, if your dreams were to come true, are you happy? And if you are, for how long? Okay. So this becomes an exploration of what is the longing within our hearts and what we want. Now, of course, from there, you can easily work out what is it that you don't want. What is it that you fear? What is it that you want to avoid? What is it that you what from whom you would like to seek refuge from? Okay. So does it make some sense? Let's do a short meditation. I'll guide you through this, to how to use this type of meditation to really get become more aware of some of our own thoughts and feelings and hopes. So, if you are, then find a comfortable, supportive posture for this meditation. It will be a short meditation. So, one that allows you to sit comfortably and will not cause you unnecessary pain or discomfort. And the most important thing is that while sitting, the posture should allow your back, your spine, to be upright in a natural way. And then you can rest your hands and arms. You can place your hands on your knees if you like, or you can place one hand on top of the other and rest them in your lap. So you rest your hands and arms in such a way that allow your shoulders to be relaxed. You don't have to tense up your arm muscles in any particular way to hold it in some weird position. You can allow your shoulders to be as relaxed as possible. And usually I suggest people to close their eyes completely. Although you're most welcome, you know, if you are familiar with other ways, you can maybe leave them half open, and you can also leave them completely open if you like. And so let's enter into this meditation where we explore what are the things that we really want or need in order for us to be happy. So let your body find its way into this posture that you have adopted. Really allow your body to feel that in this posture it is resting on something solid, firm and stable. And that your body is well supported, balanced and safe in this posture. And you can mentally tell yourself that as your body settles down into the posture, gradually at its own time, it will start to loosen up a bit, will start to unwind, and some of those unnecessary tension, tightness in the body can be released. So this is the first step of the meditation, what I call acquiring a seat for your body and mind in meditation. And then next, we're going to take a few minutes to help our body and mind to make a transition, to shift gears and to settle into meditation. So we can do that by relying on the breath, our natural breath. So we return our attention to the breath sensations in the body. We bring our attention back to the body, to the breath, so that you can fully experience your in-breath and your out-breath. So you may notice the breath sensations around your nostrils. You can feel the air flow in and out of your body. Or some of us may notice the breath sensations at the chest, movements of expansion and contraction of the chest. Or maybe some of us may notice the breath at the abdomen, a rising and falling movement. So without controlling your breath, just allow the breath to flow naturally. See if you can return your attention so that you can be aware of the breath sensation, the in-breath and the out-breath. Not to be frustrated if you do notice that your attention tends to wander off elsewhere, thinking about other things, or you find yourself very drowsy. All you need to do is, as much as possible, see if you can remind yourself to return your attention to the breath. Just come back to the breath again and again. And each time you come back, just allow yourself to experience the simple sensation. By returning your mind, your attention back to the breath sensation, it helps to reconnect your mind, your attention with your own body. The connection of mind and body is re-established, and this will help your body and mind to set aside unnecessary things, unwanted tension, tightness, and gradually they can slowly settle down into the meditation. And coming back to the breath, if you like, you can pay special attention to your out-breath. Breathing out, you can experience a sense of release. As we release the stale air in our lungs, when you breathe out, you can mentally remind yourself with the word release. Breathing out, releasing, maybe some of the tiredness, some of the tension in your body, some of the unnecessary tightness and contractions can flow away with the breath. Allow wise, when you come back to the breath, you pay attention to the breath, and as you breathe out, you can also release the different type of thoughts or images, memories, inner commentaries that preoccupy your mind. You can allow those words and images to just flow away with the breath. And so that is the second step, taking some time, a few minutes at the beginning of meditation, just to help our body and mind to shift gears. And for the third step, to deepen the meditation, we're going to let go of the breath and instead pay attention to this guiding question. We're going to ask ourselves this question: what do I really need? What do I really want in order for me to be happy? So you can drop that question into your mind and heart and see what sort of answers may come forth. May come forth in the form of words or images. So just repeat the question at your own pace, slowly, mindfully, and collect the answers that come forth. You might want to dwell on each answer a bit, elaborate on it, confirm it for yourself. But see if you can make a simple list in your own mind. What are the things that you really need or want in order for you to be really happy? As usual, you may find that your mind gets a bit distracted. You might wander off quite a bit from the theme of the meditation. And that's not a problem at all. All you need to do when you become aware of it is to ask the question again. What do I really want in order for me to be happy? Ask the question, drop it into your own heart, and just explore for yourself in the privacy of your meditation. What are the things that you feel are really necessary in order for you to be happy? tuna and then come back to the question, ask the guiding question, realign your attention, and explore this theme, this topic for yourself. What are the things that I really want to need in order for me to be happy? Coming back to the question, asking yourself, what do I really need in order for me to be happy? See if you can do it with great sincerity, and not to be too concerned with what are the so-called right answers, maybe right answers coming to Buddhism or coming to somebody else. Just ask it to your own heart so that you can discover what are the fundamental needs and wants that you have in order for you be truly happy. And then when you're ready, if you want to, you can explore the next part of the meditation, which is to say, to imagine at this very moment, all those things that you have on your list, the many or few items that you have on your list that you really want, need, all of them are fulfilled. They're all present with you in this very moment. Imagine yourself in that situation, in that circumstances, where you have everything you need in order to be happy. Imagine yourself in that situation, and allow yourself to feel. See if you can, as you imagine yourself in your most ideal situation, see if you can allow in the sense of happiness that you long for, that you look for. And ask yourself, am I truly happy when all my wishes are fulfilled? that is probably about 20 minutes, I think. So that's one meditation on exploring what we think we need or want in order for us to be happy. And it is an important topic to consider in relation to refuge, because refuge then becomes what is it that can help you to achieve what you feel you need to be happy, and more or it's something that can protect you from whatever it is that is contrary to that, that is unwanted or unneeded, or that might bring you suffering. Right? So that's why this is closely related with the topic of refuge that we are talking about. So before I continue, is there any question or comments? I hope you find at least a few things that you think you need to be happy. Otherwise, you're doomed to be unhappy. And then, what can we say? Any question up to this point? Maybe hope it makes some sense and see where I'm coming from. Yeah. Long time ago when I first encountered Buddhism and got interested in it. Actually, I started off with meditation. I'm more interested in meditation than Buddhism. Then after I meditated for a while, I wanted to have some kind of framework or knowledge to know what the heck I'm doing in meditation. So I try out different systems, and finally I thought, I think Buddhism makes the most sense to me. Right? That's how I got involved in Buddhism and studied Buddhism. And quite early on, I had this idea as I studied the Buddhist teaching. This is my own idea, that actually Buddhism, the happiness that Buddhism talk about is a peculiar kind of happiness. Buddhism doesn't actually, like for example, like I ask you, what is it that you need or want to be happier? I don't think the way Buddhism bring me to happiness is not by fulfilling what I want or what I need, what I think I want or need in order to be happy. Actually, what Buddhism did is it changes my definition of happiness. So it changed my definition of happiness, so it changed my list. It changed the list of things that I feel I need or want in order to be happy. So, that's how I think Buddhism works. I do believe Buddhism brings me to happiness, but not by necessarily fulfilling my current list of what I need or want in order for me to be happy, but that when I think when I eventually arrive at the so-called goal of happiness or peace or nirvana, happiness, actually my definition of happiness has changed. And therefore, the list that goes along with this new definition of happiness will be a very different one from the one that I start off with. So that's how I understand the topic of happiness in relation to the Buddhist teaching. Okay. Right, so if there's no question, then we need to ask the next question is, so given that we explore happiness and what I feel I need or what I long for in order for me to be happy, then we need to ask the important question is, what are the things or what we call objects or refuge that are reliable, that I can rely on in order for me to achieve happiness, or in order for me to avoid suffering. Okay. Because, I mean, what's the point of relying on an unreliable object or refuge, right? That didn't give you what you want, and didn't give you what you need, and end up giving you what you don't want and what you don't need. But this sort of a waste of time, isn't it? No, that only means that it's going to be a long trip of disappointment, which is what happens quite often. We develop some faith or trust, could be in a religious sense or even in an interpersonal sense with other people. We trust someone, we care for someone, we love, and then we end up feeling betrayed, feeling disappointed when the person or the object or the religion didn't sort of meet our expectation. Or turn out to be quite different from what I want or what I need or what I'm seeking. And so that's a very fundamental issue and something that is good to really consider, especially early on in your spiritual journey. You know, start by, like they say, look carefully before you jump. Because otherwise, after you jump, you commit, you get involved, you get engaged, you invest a lot of time and energy and money into it. And then if it turn out to be something not what you expect, you can be very disappointed. It can be very painful also. Yeah. Not a long time ago, I think there was this movie. I think one of those Golden Child. I think there was a movie called Golden Child. Talk about all this Tibetan Lama get reincarnated. Things like that. There was this story. It's a purely commercial movie. And it's set, part of the movie is set in what you would think is Tibet, you know, this is a monastery with little monks wearing maroon robes, you know, sort of like, and at least not strictly Buddhist, but you know, there's this whole idea of they discover so-called reincarnation, you know, and then they're worshipping some special jewel or something that turn out to be some alien civilization's it's a spaceship from an alien civilization. So there was this scene towards the end of the movie where this young monk ran up and saw this so-called dragon, but actually it's a spaceship from an alien civilization, and said, oh no, my religion is a mistake. So I always remember the scene. Then I said, well, I wouldn't be so sure that my religion, the religion that I chose, may also be a mistake. Right? So I always think that it's important to check, to re-examine and to look closely in what it is that you place your trust in, and to make sure that this is really what you entrust yourself to, and it's really something to your benefit, or if not misleading you, you know, or leading you to towards a goal or a result that is not really what you want, what you seek. Okay, so this is very relevant in the topic of refuge. So, we need to look closely at what are the objects upon which we place our trust that we seek refuge in. And then if you've got the right object, what happens is by placing your trust in the right object, then the advantage of is that it is a truly reliable one, then you gain the benefit that this becomes a support for you. Supports you during bad times and also during good times. It supports you to find the happiness that you long for. It supports you to face the difficulties or challenges in your life. So it is a very important issue. So you can look a bit closer at the three objects of refuge taught in Buddhism. So today we're going to, this session, we're going to look at the Buddha jewel. Right. And is the Buddha a reliable object of refuge? Our more important question is, who or what is a Buddha? Right. And then you have to decide for yourself, is this someone or something that I would place my trust in? I think of refuge as that different people will come to refuge via different pathways. So in Buddhism, we have three. We have the Buddha, which is like the golden statue there. I don't think he actually looked like this. Like gilded in gold. Very uncomfortable, right? Yeah. So there's the Buddha. There's the Dharma, which is the teaching, or sometimes people think of it as the reality of truth, the truth. Yeah. And the third object is what we call Sangha, which is a community of practitioners, of people following the path. Right? So today we're going to look at the Buddha. And then as I introduced this idea of Buddha, you really need to think about, and you can have a very different idea of Buddha from me, yeah. But the most important question is this a reliable object? And some people will come to Buddhism through the pathway of mainly through entrusting to the Buddha jewel. It's what attracts them, it's what they have faith in, but you know, it's not so difficult to have faith, right? You go to Waterloo Street, the Kuan Yin Temple, you pray, and then you do the divination. Oh, and then you got the right answer, and then well, maybe the illness you pray to recover from recovered, or the lottery you seek, you strike the lottery, and then you must remember to go and hang the coin in, Yeah, then you have faith. Because through praying or to this particular object, you achieve what you want, right? So that's actually a very common way for a lot of us to develop a sense of trust or faith. Right? And sometimes my sister told me, because I don't usually go, you pray to Guan Yin. Actually, also, there's a lot of other deities, right? Taoist deities. Then you go, come out, and then there's a Hindu temple, right? You also go in and pray, You don't put all your eggs in one basket. You just sort of spread it out. Anyway, you're more interested in getting what you want, as in who you're praying to, right? So there's some people's mentality also. So I think it's, there are people who come to refuge, come to entrust by in relation to a particular object, or in this case, a Buddha. Others come to Buddhism to refuge through studying the Buddha's teaching, and then finding it so helpful, so true, so beneficial. So then that is more like the pathway through the Dharma jewel. Then others is through coming into contact with Buddhist practitioners, and been so inspired by them, and also benefited through that interaction. So that is through the community. Community could be a single person or more than one person, and really see the benefits, or really see the been benefited through that interaction, and therefore come to refuge through the Sangha. Of course, you can go to all three or two, but I think different people come to develop their sense of trust in different ways. So you also need to know yourself. Okay, sounds all right. So let's start with the Buddha jewel as an object of refuge. Who or what is the Buddha? Not an easy question, actually. In fact, if you were to stop and ask Buddhists, different Buddhists, right? Different traditions. Singapore, very wonderful. We have Buddhism from many different countries, many different lineage and backgrounds. If you around us, who is the Buddha? What is the Buddha? You can actually get many different answers to that. And so I share with you some of my ideas of Buddhist, who or what is the Buddha, for your reference, and you can also have your own ideas about it. And the most important thing then is the Buddha someone reliable that you can entrust? I have my own personal idea of a Buddha. You can call it what I would call a humanistic Buddha, which means primarily a human being. So that's why during Visakh, recently, that you go and face a Buddha, that little Buddha with a hand pointing, I don't remember which hand, one hand pointing out, one pointing down. Because the legend says that the Buddha, even his birth is miraculous. He didn't come out through the normal channel. He came out through the C-section, cesarean of an ancient way, right? And the Buddha, Maya, his mother, was holding onto the tree branch, standing upright, and then he was born from one side, C-section, as they said. Yeah. And then apparently they would walk and talk the moment he landed. He took seven steps, and every step a lotus will bloom. And then he would say, I'm the Lord of the world, or something like that. I don't remember. What is it? Yeah. I always thought, this is an ancient fairy tale, okay? Right. So if you can see why I call my version of Buddha humanistic. I think he's just born the usual way, Conceived in the usual way and born in the usual way, okay? Even his conception is also very different. In the legend, he's conceived when his mother dreamt of, an elephant. Elephant that came from, maybe Tushita heaven, and entered into her womb. And ta-da! Miraculous conception. So, different people have different, based on the birth story of the Buddha, you can tell different people have different idea of who a Buddha is, in this case, Shakyamuni Buddha, historical Buddha. So in my own version, my way of thinking of the Buddha, I think of him as just a human being, a very intelligent human being, very special human being nonetheless. Someone who is really preoccupied with the problem of suffering in life. And it's really deeply affected him to the extent that he's willing to give up the career, give up his career path, it's literally a career suicide. And then he's supposed to be the son of king, or these days people think that it's not really a king, but a chief. Yeah. Give up that and took on the life of a wandering mendicant, a spiritual practitioner, wandering around, meeting different teachers, learning from them, practicing meditation, seeking the answers, to the question of suffering. And then, to cut a long story short, then around one day he came to the Bodhi tree in Bodhgaya, sat down under the tree and vowed that he would not get up from that seat until he achieved enlightenment. Don't do that, okay? You might find yourself sitting there for very long. Don't make that vow unless you're very sure about yourself. You might regret it. Say, I really need to go to the toilet. I haven't got enlightened yet. Yeah. But so he had an awakening experience under the Bodhi tree. And this is usually in the legend, it's very graphic. Because after all, inner transformation is very hard to make into a movie, right? So you need to, and also very hard to tell a story of an inner spiritual transformation. And therefore, it's almost become personalized. The obstacle maya, the mara, the obstacle has given form, right? So there's stories of how Mara sends his daughters to seduce the Buddha. So this stands for craving, different type of craving, greed, and then send his army, Mara's army, which represents fear, to attack the Buddha, during the night, the evening, before his enlightenment, and he's able to subdue the Mara's daughters, the enemies, the armies. And finally, the last obstacle is Mara himself, who appear, and this movie, they call it Little Buddha, that Keanu Reeves starred in, and there was this scene, where he saw his reflection in the water, right? And that is actually the illusion created by Mara. The last obstacle is actually self-doubt. Mara asks, who you think you are to sit here and think that you can achieve something called enlightenment, that you can conquer the armies of Mara and you can achieve freedom from liberation from suffering. This, actually, if you want to analyze it psychologically, this is self-doubt. What may you think you, among all those millions of human beings, you will be the one to achieve awakening and enlightenment. Yeah. And the Buddha is able to see through that illusion, right? And he has an awakening experience. There's a story where he opened his eyes and he saw the morning star. And that moment he achieved awakening, enlightenment. Yeah. He's also known after we study to have achieved enlightenment in one go. He didn't have stages. He didn't go to stage one, stage two. It's like one night, sat down under the Bodhi tree and everything go. Wonderful, isn't it? Subsequently, it's a bit harder. The subsequent disciples, they go through a different way of describing the stages. Some describe 4 stages, 10 stages. So the Buddha did it all in one shot, and achieved a state of enlightenment or awakening. And I like to think of it as the awakening to the reality of life itself. See it so clearly, so thoroughly, that all the delusion, that obscure our mind, the delusion upon which we develop our greed, our hatred, our sense of jealousy or arrogance or conceit, all those delusions are built on. So all these are dispelled in that one awakening experience, and he became the Buddha. And you probably know the word Buddha, the Bu, come from the root of to wake up, you know, wake up from a dream, wake up from sleep. So then he became a Buddha and spent the rest of his life traveling in the southern part of India and just trying to convey what he realized to others, to help others also to realize the same truth. And that realization, that awakening, supposedly freed him from suffering. Now, then he asked, what sort of suffering has, in this case, a humanistic Buddha been freed from? Does it mean that he doesn't have to can stay young forever? Does it mean that he can live forever? He doesn't have to have any illness? In my version, or the version I believe in, doesn't seem the case, right? He grow old, he lives up to 80 years old. He grew weak, he suffer from illness, and he died probably from some form of food poisoning. Yeah, and he experienced death, right? And also the other type of suffering is encountering unpleasant things. Oh, there are lots of stories, not even in the scriptures, of how the Buddha encountered different unpleasant events after his enlightenment. Right? One of the major ones is his followers. There is what we call a schism. It means the Sangha at one point split into two groups. You know, his cousin Devadatta, because Devadatta led a kind of a schism and took off with part of the followers. Yeah. And also, he also has to be separated from those that are close to him. Like, for example, the Sakya clan, his own family, his tribe, were massacred when a nearby and neighboring kingdom invaded. Yeah. So the Buddha did try to stop the invading army. He did it first time. I think basically he just sat on the middle of the road and stopped the army from advancing. Yeah. He did it two times, but the third time they detour and attacked. So he lost at least all his so-called relatives in that sense. So he also encountered things that are unpleasant. He's separated from pleasant things. Yeah. And so in my version, well, this would be what we consider suffering for ordinary people, isn't it? But yet, I think that he didn't suffer in the conventional way, because he can able to see all these events and experiences from a very different perspective. And from that, from his more awakened or enlightened perspective, then these are no longer sources of suffering. And so that's how I see the awakening of the Buddha and how that freed him from suffering. Okay. So this is one version of a Buddha. And this is the Buddha jewel that if I say I take refuge in, this is the one that I go for refuge in. But then there are other versions, other way of understanding who or what is the Buddha. Right? So this is from the Mahayana tradition. And this way of thinking of the Buddha, sometimes I call it a cosmic Buddha. So it's not bound to a single individual human being, a historical figure. This is Mahayana tends to be more transcendental, take a more cosmic view, and that's when you sometimes hear of we talk about the three bodies of the Buddha, the three kayas, yeah, the Dhammakaya, the Sambhogakaya, the Nimanakaya. Kaya means body in Sanskrit. Yeah, the three bodies of the Buddha are three different embodiments of enlightenment. Like enlightenment was to take a form. There are three different levels. I sometimes also, just to make it more lighthearted, I call this the cosmic jelly model of Buddha. Cosmic jelly, you know, the jelly this day. I don't, not so common this day, you know, you can buy this packet of jelly for sugar and coloring and gelatin, and then you into this hot water, and dissolve it, alright? That's the first stage, okay? The dissolved jelly, right? The jelly permeates the entire of hot water, but no form. Right? All were. That's the first one, first level. Then what you do, you pour it into the mold, right? Okay, and leave it out to cool. Right, you don't stick it into the fridge. You leave it out to cool. Right? So what happens is then the jelly, which is formless, you know, it doesn't have a fixed form. Once it's in the mold, it starts to set. It acquire a kind of a form, right? It very much depend on the mold itself, right? So this is the second stage. It starts to have a kind of subtle form, subtle shape, right? And then you stick it into the fridge, and let's suppose that you have this jelly that has a high gelatin content. And then when it sets, you can invert it, it come out, and it has actually a fixed form, isn't it, that you can serve as a dessert, right? Okay. So there's this is the third stage. The first stage is formless. The second stage has a subtle form, depending on the condition, the mold that you use. And the third stage, it has like sort of an independent form. That normally just sort of landed on your plate. Okay? This is the three embodiments of the Buddha. Okay? So you can think of enlightenment. I'm sure you never heard this explanation before. Okay? And you will make a deep impression. You will always remember the cosmic jelly model of the Buddha. Okay? And this is how sometimes in Mahayana we think of enlightenment. There are these three aspects. Right? The one that we are most familiar with, the final jelly version. Right? So that is called Nirmanakaya or emanation body. That's almost as if enlightenment take a human form and actually appear in front of you that you can talk to, that can inspire you, that you know, actually literally walk on earth. So Shakyamuni Buddha is that final jelly, okay? Right. So it's almost like enlightenment is so abstract, right? Yet when it appears in a human form that is very similar to you and yet different, and you can relate to it, and you can inspire you, and you can receive teaching from. Right? And in, of course, in Mahayana tradition, the historical Buddha is not the only enlightened Buddha. Right? Long after, you know, after him, every generation, someone or more than one person attained enlightenment. You know? So it's almost like even now, maybe you know, there might be Buddhas walking among us, you know, in human form that we can make connection with, we can talk to, and they can help us, they can inspire us, they can teach us, you know, maybe not necessarily in a formal way, but also in an informal way about the teaching, how to helping us to achieve enlightenment. Also. So that's one version, one level. Then there is that the jelly in the mold. Right, the subtle form. So not only can we connect with enlightenment, the awakening in a human-to-human way, but there are also in certain situations when our consciousness is more pure, you know, or more in a more altered state, then we can receive teachings, we can receive inspiration within like maybe a meditative state. You might have heard stories of people meditate and the Buddha appeared to them, you know, and they receive teachings from the Buddha. You know, and so that Buddha that appear to a more purified, clear mind, you know, has a form, but it's not a form that like, not like this kind of form or like a human body, but a color and shape, but much more subtle. And not everybody can see that Buddha, right? Not everybody can connect with that, but those that can receive inspiration and receive teaching from. So that is the jelly that is know, inside the mold, not quite set yet. So it's available, it's accessible to people with pure mind. Okay, so that's the second type of embodiment. And the last one, the jelly that is melted in hot water and is all pervaded, is what we call Dharmakaya. That means, it's almost like the Buddha is enlightenment is all pervasive, you know, all pervade all of reality. All space and time. And of course we, even here, you know, and the Buddha is in a way here, but of course we cannot access it. We, you know, it doesn't have a form. It's not something that we can see or hear or touch, but nonetheless it's available. You know, it's not, so that is the most subtle, most difficult to understand aspect of enlightenment. So that's the three and I call it three kayas in Sanskrit, you know, Dharmakaya, the melted jelly, right? Then the Sambhogakaya, enjoyment body, is the form of the Buddha that is only appear to a pure mind, you know, in certain special meditative states. And finally, the Nirmanakaya, the emanation body, the body that the Buddha that actually walk around and that you can actually have human contact with, they can receive teaching from. Right? So that is another way of thinking about enlightenment. So this is what I call a more cosmic Buddha. So it's not bound to a single historical person. And it's a very encouraging model, because it means that even now, we can actually encounter the Buddha in one form or another. The enlightenment, the Buddha is still available. And also, more importantly, that maybe we ourselves can achieve enlightenment. We also can be Buddha. You know, we can be, you know, we can also be like one of the form Buddha. Right? So enlightenment is actually available. So this is another way of thinking about Buddha. Just don't tell people that it's the cosmic jelly model, all right? You'll be very offended by it. But I thought it's a good idea, but usually people don't remember, right? And also the names are a bit cheap, you know, Dhammakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirvanakaya. You can remember all these names. But it gives you an idea that maybe enlightenment is not so restricted to a single historical figure. But it's actually something available, and we can access it, we can connect with it in many different ways, in a human form, in a more kind of spiritual way, and even if we are not aware, it is still, maybe in some way, it is still with us, that the Buddha is still with us. Okay, any question? I'm quite proud of me coming up with the example of the jelly, you know. I really am. So I always talked about the cosmic jelly Buddha. Yeah. So we're going to do a short meditation together to just have to explore this idea of connecting with the Buddha jewel. So this meditation was taught to me by my teacher, Rangpa Sangyekhadro. I don't think it's very traditional. Yeah. I think Rangpa borrowed it from somewhere. Definitely, I never hear Tibetan Lama taught it this way, but I really like it. It's a kind of guided visualization. And not to worry if you're like me, you can't really visualize. But at least the idea is you start by imagining yourself. Actually, you can call this meditation meeting the Buddha, going to meet the Buddha. Yeah. Start out yourself in a place that represents samsara, you know, where we are. Right? The original version, remember, was describing an Indian marketplace. I don't know whether I'm not quite sure. This is not Little India, okay? This is India, okay? Yeah. But it's very, very loud, you know. And also, I'm sure it's very, lots of scents, a lot of smells, you know, all the spices and, you know, lots of people. It's a very chaotic location, place. And so then you imagine walking out of this marketplace and you just walk away from it. You found a path, you walk away, and as you travel along that path, you find that you left that village, that marketplace behind. You come to a more tranquil place, like, you know, in a park or something like that. And far ahead of you, you saw a huge big tree, the Bodhi tree. And you have a sense that the Buddha is sitting there, up there. You know. So you walk, you take this path, you walk and leave behind all the noise, all the chaos, you know, disturbance, and walk towards the tree. And then as you turn the ground, you saw the Buddha sitting under the tree. So you sat, imagine yourself sitting in front of the Buddha, you know, and this is like the close encounter with the Buddha, you know, of within your mind, okay? And then, you know, then you can do different things. You can ask questions, or sometimes ask you to sit there and soak in the blessing of the Buddha. Yeah. I don't know whether you heard my alternate version of this. I told this story because I don't like to visualize the Buddha. You know, I look at all the different images of the Buddha and say, I'm sure he doesn't look like this, right? So a bit weird, right? Or just some look a bit Thai, the other look a bit, you know, Chinese, you know, look like an Indian prince to me, yeah. So my version is, instead of going to the front to see the Buddha, I go to the back, right? You know, the tree, and the Buddha is on the other side, I go to the back of the Buddha. I quite like it. Yeah. So I just, like, hug the tree. I think that, oh, the Buddha is on the other side, right? And I receive blessing via the tree. Okay? without actually seeing the Buddha. Because for me, then I don't have to visualize the Buddha, and yet I can be in his presence. So you can choose which version you want on it. So let's do a meditation on meeting the Buddha. Okay, so as usual, just settle yourself in a meditation posture. Take a few deep breaths, and as you breathe out, remind yourself to release. Allow your body and mind to settle back once again into a meditative state, into the meditation posture. Allow the breath to flow naturally, following its own natural rhythm. And take a few moments at the beginning of meditation, just rest your attention on the breath, and just invite your attention to come back to the breath, to reconnect your body with your mind, your attention. And as you breathe out, remember to release. Release the tensions in your face. So often we unconsciously tense up the muscles of the face. And as you breathe out, see if you can just gently soften, relax those muscles of your face. Let in the feeling of softness, the feeling of ease and comfort into your own face. Similarly, coming back to the breath again and again, be very patient with yourself, with your own body and mind. And each time you breathe out, just gently remind yourself with the word release. Almost as if in its own time, the body can release the tightness, the tension, the contraction. The mind can set aside again and again the different thoughts, images not related to the meditation. Body and mind slowly can settle back into meditation. So I'll guide you in this visualization of meeting the Buddha, but you're most welcome to ignore what I'm saying. You are most welcome to conduct the meditation in your own way, in a way that is meaningful to you, that is effective for you. And feel free to change any elements within it to make it more beneficial for yourself. So let's imagine we start this journey at a place that symbolizes our samsaric life, a life that is very busy. We are constantly bombarded with lots of stimulation, lots of stress. Traditionally, my teacher advised us to visualize an Indian marketplace. Lots of noise, lots of smell, lots of people, activity. I like to visualize myself in one of Singapore shopping malls. Lights, people, activities. A symbol of our current life. And when you feel ready, look for the nearest exit and begin to walk towards it, to walk away from the chaos, from the noise, from all the sensory stimulations. Leave it behind for the time being. Walk out of the exit and visualize yourself walking on a path. The path can be of any form, any shape, a path that leads you away from the stress, from the busyness, from the stimulation, a path that takes you towards somewhere more peaceful, more calm, more joyful. Imagine taking the path, walking away from from all the busyness. And imagine the path leads in the distance towards a tree, a huge big tree, the Bodhi tree. And somehow you know under that tree, on the other side, will be the Buddha, the embodiment of enlightenment, of awakening. So take your time, walk towards the tree. When you feel ready, turn the corner and arrive in front of the Buddha. Take a seat in the presence of the Buddha. And ask yourself, how does the Buddha appear to you? Give him any form that comes to mind, a form that resonates with you. And as you gaze at the Buddha in this form, ask yourself, what does the Buddha symbolize for you? What are the qualities embodied by the Buddha for you? As you continue the meditation, if you do find yourself distracted, then it's quite normal. You turn your attention to the Buddha, and in the teachings, we're always advised to think of the Buddha looking at us with eyes of great love, kindness, and compassion, and great patience. And imagine yourself sitting in his presence, and reflect on what you know about the Buddha. Who is the Buddha to you? What are some of his qualities that inspire you, that attract you? Coming back to the meditation, imagine yourself sitting in the presence of the Buddha. Don't feel that you need to say anything or do anything. See if you can just allow yourself to enjoy sitting in his presence. You can sit with your eyes closed or open. But the most important thing in this visualization is to imagine that you are in the presence of the Buddha. And then as you continue, imagine yourself in the presence of the Buddha. Think that from the heart of the Buddha, radiant light emerges in whichever form that you can visualize. Some of that light comes to you, touches your body, flowing into your body, illuminating your body. The light represents the inspiration flowing from the Buddha. Inspiration from his enlightenment, these inner qualities. Imagine them flowing into you, touching you, inspiring you, awakening your own potential to be enlightened, to be a Buddha. And see if you can, as you sit in his presence, be receptive, be open, and receive that inspiration in the form of light. Coming back to the visualization, think that the light the inspiration from Buddha, nourishes your own Buddha potential, or what we call Buddha nature. That within each one of us, we all possess the seeds, the potential, to also be enlightened, to awaken, to become a Buddha. See if you can imagine and believe in that Buddha potential within yourself. We too can develop loving kindness, compassion, and wisdom. And we can also be free from ignorance, from greed, from hatred. And to conclude this short visualization, just remind yourself everything within this visualization, this meditation, every place, the tree, the Buddha, it all came from your own mind, from your own heart. And it's to your own mind and heart, they now return. Allow the visualization to dissolve. And think of the Buddha as always residing within your own heart and mind. So there is a very short visualization of meeting the Buddha. And within our Tibetan Buddhist tradition, this kind of visualization, not quite like that, but something like this, visualizing the Buddha in the space in front of you, light flowing from him or her, if you are visualizing a female Buddha, the Buddha dissolving into you. These are very common elements in the practice. Visualization is as a way of staying connected with the Buddha jewel. Okay, so any questions or comments? Do you know who is the Buddha? No? Or have I confused you more? Then, yeah, yes. Do I think that the quality of meditation changes? Well, definitely, because it's a different type of meditation. Yeah. And I think also it affects different people differently. Some people maybe are more resonate stronger with meditation that involves like visualizing the Buddha or imagining in the presence of a holy being. Some people resonate stronger with that, especially when it back to the jelly model, it's a fully formed jelly, right? Then they feel that they can connect with it better, have a stronger impact. And others prefer the pot of dissolved jelly, the formless kind of meditation. Well, in other words, you don't, not so much the Buddha personally, but like, let's say the teaching, you know, certain truth or certain facts. Some people resonate better, some people prefer the meditation on what do I really need in order to be happy. And you may find that that grabs their attention stronger. I mean, those sort of people, you ask me that, I find more involved in that kind of meditation. Whereas with meditation of Buddha, I always saying, oh, I think Buddha is a bit too fat. No, I used to do this. I used to struggle much harder with visualization of Buddha. No, I want him to look proportional and expose himself indecently, you know, must wrap the cloth, wrap in the right way, right color. But I haven't had this experience. I really struggle very hard to get the perfect Buddha appear. And then suddenly the Buddha image stand up and walk off. You know? So I said, well, that's it. Forget about it. So you're right. The qualities are different because we affect us differently. And different of us resonate stronger with different types of meditation. Yeah. The jelly is all pervasive. It's always there. You know, I'm stretching the analogy a little bit too much, right? Yeah. Sure. I think, yeah. Yeah. To Buddhism, yeah. Yeah, yes. In fact, I can say that there's a difference when, let's say, I just meditate, right? I'm interested in meditation, I meditate, but with a very kind of, very normal kind of mentality, you know, trying to find happiness, or maybe I just find some peace in my meditation. So from that kind of mindset to one in which, like maybe after learning about the Dharma and really practicing for a while, you develop kind of an inner confidence, a kind of a sense of connection with the idea of with enlightenment or awakening. You really, sometimes you get this real sense that, you know, that there is something called awakening, that there is possible. And that, and of course it comes in many different forms for different people. Like some people feel that they have a real connection with a Buddha form, you know. If Tara appears, you know, they visualize Tara, they really feel connected with it and they feel very peaceful, you know. So when you have that kind of experience, it changes your meditative experience, you know, because it gives a different basis upon which you meditate. So when, let's say when you're new, you're beginner, or you don't really have that kind of experience, or at least belief, you are building on a very different foundation, or one in which when you develop faith or trust and refuge. You know? So the two types of meditation are on very different foundations, and therefore very different experience. In fact, what happens is when you have trust, meditation can become almost effortless. You know? It's not like a struggle to be successful and don't want to fail in meditation. It's more like sometimes people say it's like, oh, I can relax, you know, I can settle down and just this sense of entrusting that things will happen or things will unfold in a very positive way because of that sense of trust or faith or refuge. Yeah. And so the whole quality of the meditation shift from one in which sometimes you're always struggling, trying to, oh, am I doing the right thing or am I doing the wrong thing? To one in which even the attitude is there's no such thing as right or wrong. Know that whatever happens, happens, and that you can always benefit from that kind from your meditation. So you can see that there can be a great difference. And I think the difference comes from the foundation. You know, one of sense of trust and refuge, and one in which you don't really have that sense of trust. You don't really have that kind of refuge. Right, so that is that's all for this session. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'll see you next week.
chair here. If you want to move the chair, put here. But if you don't want to put the, you don't want to move the chair here, then just leave it. I will keep it. If not, I have to move it up and down. Thank you.